It is our great pleasure to have Billy Collins with us here on the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell?
One of the advantages of doing radio is people can't see what you're actually doing, and what people probably don't know is we've strapped you in this chair and attached...
Without my clothes.
Right.
Without your clothes, attached all sorts of leads, galvanic skin resistance we can measure, respiration we can measure, heartbeat we can measure, and we're going to extort from you.
Torture.
This thing on my head's a little tight, that band. Could you loosen that up?
Depends on whether you answer the question.
Yeah.
And we're going to torture you until you tell us the meaning.
Paul and I both came to poetry very, very late. Thomas Lux is the reason. He moved in next door and insisted, and about the same time we met Nikki Giovanni.
Move in next door,
no,
but we had the pleasure of meeting her. It's a crowded neighborhood, but not that crowded.
You were talking about poetry having to be serious, and I sort of felt that way growing up, because in school you had to read the poems, then you had to memorize poems, and it was one of those things that I swore it once I spouted that last line out that I absolutely positively had to memorize, I never wanted to see the stuff again, and it was serious.
Lugubrious.
And it, how to say the catchword a few years back, was relevance, and it was very hard to connect to the poetry that the limited amount that was available. And then I come back in your work and Thomas's work, and turns out lots of people are creating worlds that are inhabitable and interesting and challenging and funny. And that's not what I thought poetry was supposed to be. Where did you go astray?
Where did you push those other guys back?
Well, where have you been is the question. You,
right.
You guys left and we kept going.
Yeah.
Well, that's probably right, isn't it?
Yeah, I think because our exposure to poetry starts in school, essentially. I mean, it's preschool, because as children we love rhyming games, mm-hmm. and we love wordplay, and but once we get to this formal thing called poetry, we get it in school, and like anything, like trigonometry, it comes with grades and teachers and blackboards and
pass,
assignments
fail,
and pass fail,
lots
and
of disincentives,
all of these other academic anxieties, and that's why people get to, it's the same reason that people quit the piano. You know, I mean, 90% of, well, let's say 81%.
You and I, at least.
Yeah. 66% of the people in this room, at least, played the piano and took piano lessons as children. And then we stopped whenever we could.
As soon as we could.
Yeah, and we either just walked away from it, or we picked up the guitar, because that was a cooler instrument to play. And the music we were playing on the piano, remember, were like the Thompson exercise books, and we were playing you start with hot cross buns and stuff like that. And my mother tried to convince me that if you played the piano, you'd be popular. And then at some point, I realized that that young girls were not really turned on by the song of the Volga Boatman. Which I mastered.
Alas.
And the song of the Volga Boatman was kind of the musical equivalent of studying Tennyson or William Cullen Bryant or Henry Wadsworth Longfellow. Essentially, these poets who were white, dead, and had three names. And that's what I studied in school. So you then think, well, that's poetry. Well, it isn't poetry, really. It's a certain kind of poetry that's, 50 or 200 years old. And when you drop out of poetry, as you just confessed having done, if you tune in again, you find out that poetry has moved along and that now has a very contemporary sound, as it always does. And
as it probably did to Longfellow's era.
Yeah, right. It does not sound it's hard to imagine that the poetry right now will sound antique at some point. But so every age has a problem imagining its own styles being outmoded.
But this is really a matter of voice. I mean, almost a generation finding its voice, and that voice is going to be different depending on the circumstances, depending on the predicates, and that's a big part of it, isn't it?
The reason I came up with this Poetry 180 program for high schools was, one of the reasons was to expose high school students to poems as they're written today, poems by Tom Lux and you know, contemporary poets that are writing right today. Because even if you have a pretty hip teacher in high school who likes poetry, the textbooks and the anthologies are always trailing, you know, way behind the sound of poetry today.
The reason that Bill said that about Strapping You Down, you have a wonderful poem where you're inviting people into the delights of poetry, and all they want to do is torture the poor little sucker and figure out, and this was what I was taught, what does it really mean? What can we get it to divulge?
What's he trying to say?
Yeah, what's the meaning behind the meaning?
That's one of the great insulting questions. What's he trying to say? As if as if every poetic attempt is a failure. He's tried to say something. He has failed to say it. But our seventh grade class will say it for him.
Crack the code.
Right, and we'll say it. We'll figure out what he really wanted to say.
Well, is it just the seventh grade class? Because I have a sense that there are lots of academics at higher level institutions that do that same kind of thing.
There are a lot of pleasures that come out of poetry, and I once wrote an article called Poetry Pleasure in the Hedonist Reader, and I listed six or seven pleasures, and the last pleasure was the pleasure of meaning. I wouldn't have stayed in graduate school and gotten a PhD in English literature if I didn't enjoy explication and analysis and interpretation. That's an intellectual pleasure. And it's pleasurable to kind of put your head against a difficult poem and figure out its patterns. But there are many other pleasures, and the pleasures of rhythm, the pleasures of watching metaphorical connections, the pleasures of going on an imaginative journey, the pleasures of memorization and the musical aspect. Unfortunately, these other pleasures do not require the presence of teachers.
Oops.
It's a hammer problem, isn't it?
Yeah. So when poetry becomes institutionalized in an academic world, and teachers stand as the priest, you know, intervening between the student and these godlike figures, the writers, then the emphasis is entirely on interpretation.
Now, it's important to say you are also a teacher. So you're talking of, these are family stories you're telling.
Yeah, I'm kind of nibbling at the hand that feeds me too. But I've found ways to teach poetry that do not that present alternatives to just what does the poem mean.
And the what does the poem mean is where I finally bailed out, because I thought, well, my goodness, if he's not going to tell me, she's not going to tell me, why should I care that they have done that? And yet, as I was, we read a lot of stuff, as you might guess. And what I found as I had the opportunity to be reading your poems in anticipation of this was I read so much stuff that I was finding myself, and it's been a fairly grim stretch of reading. It's been about politics and about economics and the working poor and America having isolated itself in the world. I mean, the usual stuff. And I found myself going to your poems to say, let me think about what this moment in time is. Let me think about that cardinal that landed on mm-hmm. the post as I was waiting for you. Let me come into something that is my world, about which I can do something or not. Mm-hmm. But that invitation back into my own life that you provided as a poet was as distant as it could be from what did he really mean?
I have a kind of crackpot theory, which is that you can take an atom and smash it, and let's just forget the subatomic world, but we'll pretend that the atom is the basic building block of matter. And if you accelerate it and smash it, it releases this amazing and sometimes frightening energy. Well, if atoms are the building blocks of matter, moments are the building blocks of time, and you can take a moment and smash it, and that's what haiku does. Haiku essentially intensifies your regarding of a single moment in time, and by focusing on that moment, you find this amazing release of energy that moment seems to actually contain all moments, and yet holds on to its integrity of the moment. So that's one thing I think much lyrical poetry tries to do, is to bring us back to this sense of the momentary. And that life is simply the string of individual discrete individual perceptions, most of them, the large majority of which we are completely oblivious to.
A haiku is also something that can drive your wife, your children, and the dog crazy if you go around and spout it all day and then write a poem about it.
True.
The Tibetan Buddhist, and I think this is characteristic in lots of other cultures, spiritual perspectives, have this notion of all these overlapping worlds that we think we're in this room doing these things, and there's another, you know, half a dozen million other dimensions all. And in some senses, those moments you talk about, and the joy of reading your poems is that it explodes those moments. They become big, and they become rich, and they become interesting, and in some ways, in the best of all possible ways, educational. With what could have been just a moment, mm-hmm. but that, you know, that minute or 2 minutes or whatever, you know, it expands into something other and different and exciting and fun.
Haiku is hard to teach because if you read a haiku, something like a cherry tree in blossom and in the distance the sound of a dog barking, something like that I just kind of made up, students will say, "So what?" And you can kind of understand that. What's the big deal, a tree and a dog barking? And I think the point is that the tree and the dog, it's not that they're so much, they have this great significance. It's the fact that the witness was there at that moment. And I saw the tree, I heard the dog. Basically, that means I was here, I was alive. It's a little like saying Kilroy was here. It's like writing your name on a wall. It is a statement of witnessing and presence.
This is Billy Collins. We will hope that the moment that we go away won't expand forever, because we're going to be right back. Be with us when we return in a moment with the Paula Gordon Show. Bill Russell and I are delighted that Billy Collins will be with us then, too.